Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Journey to Success Radio Network. Our purpose on Journey to Success Radio is to interview people who are making a positive difference in the world. We explore important aspects and areas of life, including business, sales, physical, mental, relationships, disability, leadership, and many more interesting topics. Our broadcast team consists of outstanding people from both Canada and the U.S., including several Napoleon Hill certified instructors, as well as several authors. My name is Tom Tuttle Cunningham. I'm a Napoleon Hill Foundation certified instructor. I'm also a regular contributor to their weekly newsletter, and in March of 2012, I spoke at the Napoleon Hill International Convention in Malaysia, where I shared the stage with Deepak Chopra. I've had rheumatoid arthritis from my jaw to my toes since the age of 5. That's 44 years now. And in that time, I've had 4 hips, 4 knees, and 2 shoulders replaced and been hospitalized about 40 times. I also stand about 5'1". That's due to the heavy daily doses of the oral steroid prednisone that I had to take to fight my arthritis. Despite those challenges, everyone who knows me knows I always answer amazing when asked how I'm doing. I'm also a senior editorial researcher for the Canadian Business Journal. We're a digital-only publication, and we're the official and only media partner with the Canadian Chamber of Commerce. Find out more about me and my website. It's tom2andtall.com, T-A-L-L.com. My guest today is Phil Geldart. I'm excited to have him, a great Canadian success story. Phil is the founder and CEO of Eagles Flight, North America's leading experiential learning training company. With over 1.5 million global program graduates, Eagles Flight has revolutionized how companies train with a total engagement approach that shifts the focus from the facilitator onto the participant and delivers business results through lasting behavioral changes. Phil established Eagles Flight after almost 10 years with Nestle Canada, where he was ultimately the Senior Vice President of Human Resources. And during this time, he spearheaded Nestle Canada's focus on improved profitability through more effective development and use of their human talent. Additionally, Phil has considerable experience with acquisition and divestiture initiatives. He's managed sales and distribution organizations and created a number of leadership programs. An enthusiastic practitioner of principle-based leadership, Phil is also greatly involved in developing leadership potential in youth and nonprofit organizations. He's also a best-selling author, and he's drawn from his wealth of experience and in-depth expertise in learning and leadership. In his previous book, In Your Hands, The Behaviors of a World-Class Leader, Phil created a desk-side go-to reference for senior executives. His new book, Lead Yourself, Lead Others, embraces leaders who are in the earlier stages of their career. It's an invaluable resource for all developing leaders, supporting self-mastery over personal performance and development, and delivering key foundational practices for the next generation of leadership. Welcome to the show today, Phil.
Thanks, Tom. Wow, you've had quite the journey yourself, listening to your background. Wow.
And when I read 1.5 million global program graduates, that's an impressive track record. That's just not a starting out track record. That's an amazing number of people that are graduates from your program. Tell me about the start of your company. I talk about, as part of Napoleon Hill's principles, and number one being definiteness of purpose. And it must have been maybe sometime while you were at Nestle that you really decided to passionately pursue your definite purpose. And 1.5 million graduates later, looks like people are excited about your definite purpose, right?
That's true. That's true. It actually started in my basement, Tom, 25 years ago. So I was still at Nestle at the time, and they kindly let me start up a training company in my spare time, and it just grew from there. So here we are.
Wow.
We're in about 45 countries around the world now, about 25 languages, including Braille, which was kind of neat for
Wow.
an experiential learning program. Yeah.
Okay. I need to hook you up with my friend Jim Stovall. amazing author. He's blind. He's the president of Narrative Television Network. And anything to do that helps a blind, he knows of it or should know about it. That's an amazing initiative. Training in Braille, that's probably not something that happens a lot. And so you've been doing this for some time, and this new book is out. I got a copy of it, so I'm looking forward to reading it. Tell me, because there's a lot of approaches on leadership training, so many. You've got the so many leadership authors out there. I'm thinking of, who is it, John Maxwell, one that comes to my mind. But what your book talks about behavioral changes, so it sounds like it's a little different. Tell me about your company's approach to leadership training and how this book fits in with that leadership training that you do.
Okay, I think if you were to look at us versus all the other training companies out there, there's probably two things that set us apart. The first is the leadership training is really pragmatic, in the sense that, you know, I'll often get in front of senior folks and they'll want academic training, they'll want a lot of research-based learning, and that is not us. We are really a, here is the right way to do something, this is a model. If you follow the model, you get the results. So if you think of something like change management, which is really a challenge these days, as you can imagine, there's a lot of tremendous research done on it, a lot of tremendous theory, and it's all valuable. But in our case, if you come into a leadership training program with Eagle's Flight and we have you for a day, at the end of the day, you have a very clear model, five steps, very specific things you have to do to lead effectively through change. So we are really practical. We tend to say, if it's not in your head when you leave, it doesn't exist. And I think really that's my own background. I wasn't a great student, and I hated going to class and coming back, and you have all these binders and notes and reference books, and how am I going to remember all that? So as a leader, I thought, I've got to make it so that leaders can learn exactly how to be world-class and then just go do it the next day without reference to a lot of stuff. So I think that's the first thing. Which really does set us apart. The second thing is experiential, and I think people tend to confuse experiential learning with, if you think of a spectrum, on the left-hand side, there's just sort of activities that you do, like, you know, rope climbing or something, and on the far right-hand side, there's simulations. So if you go to train a pilot in an airplane, he has a simulation. And experiential learning is kind of in the middle. It's definitely more than just an activity, but it's not a mirror image of a pilot in an airplane in a simulation. So, again, I think if you think about how people think and how people operate, we learn best by doing. We don't learn by 10,000 PowerPoints. So one of the things that, you know, I just felt, if I have to train people and they're going to sit there, they're going to be bored to death if I just do PowerPoints and case studies, and it's all theory. And what I wanted folks to do was to learn by discovering on their own. So we create a number of really high-energy games. They're like really fun games. They take about 2 hours. And they're themed, which are neat. So you cross the desert, you're in the Old West, you're in Alaska, you're different themes. And through those games, things happen. Sometimes it's collaboration, sometimes it's conflict, planning, teamwork. But you actually think you're playing this game. And people are themselves. It's not a role play. They just go off and do it. And at the end, there's a score, and we debrief for another couple of hours. Okay, so why did you get that score? What does that tell us about the way you normally approach challenges at work? And here are some very specific things you can do different, which would have changed your score in the game. And since the game is a mirror of your world, it will change how you perform at work. So they're fun. Yeah, people line up sometimes to get in our classes. It's not like people are ducking out. And they learn by doing. So I think the pragmatic nature of the material and the experiential learning is kind of what sets us apart.
I love it. And I worked for 4 years for a management consultant that specialized in implementation. So I love how you talked about that. Learn it, but then go do it. And I kind of wrote a note here. If it doesn't change behavior, it really didn't work.
Exactly.
And I've been to hundreds of seminars where it didn't change my behavior long term, might have for a few days, but then I might have forgot of or reprioritized what I learned. And so if it doesn't, let's say, make a long-term change in your behavior rather than a few days, then really it didn't work. And so that's the best way to judge a program is, can you go implement it tomorrow without having to look up three manuals with 19 steps of how to do this program? Because then you didn't learn it. You're really still just looking it up.
Exactly. And I think if you, you know, it was interesting. I backed my car out of the driveway the other day, and there was a guy driving behind me, and I hit him. I thought, oh, man, it was completely my fault. So I went out and I apologized. I said, look, I'm really sorry. But it was interesting because two things happened. Firstly, I realized, okay, the next time I back out, I'm actually going to look a lot more carefully. I thought I looked, but obviously not careful enough. So that experience taught me something. And if I can bring experiences that I learned from for myself into the leadership classroom, then behavior changes. And then the other thing, I thought, okay, there's three things I can do differently here. So I've got to check left, check right, and check the rearview mirror. And I got to do it better than I did it before. So very pragmatic. I didn't need to read a book on how not to hit the guy. And I think that little example really highlights the way I think learning should occur, especially for adults. If I can learn by experience that I discover for myself, okay, the right way to do things, and then you can tell me two or three steps, do these things and you'll get better, then I got it. I don't need someone to hammer me over the head. So that's really the essence of how we train. And it's exciting. It's fun. People love it.
Neat. And so I love training. So when I hear about that, I wonder to myself, wrote it down, how did you develop this program? Is it your own original system, or is it based on thinking of some various people? Because it sounds different, certainly, than other training I've done, and it sounds like the focus is a lot different. So how did you develop this program? How did it come to be?
Yeah, it's from me. It's not from someplace else. And I will tell you, Tom, I developed it really as a matter of survival. When the first job I had as a trainer, I was going to be a young guy from head office teaching time management and planning to a group of very senior managers at a factory in a remote location. And I said to my wife, okay, you know, this is going to be a really short career because I'm going to stand up there and they're going to go, okay, like, what do you know? Firstly, you're not from the factory. You're from head office. Secondly, you're young. And thirdly, we know everything about timing and plan management. I mean, planning and time management. So I sat at my kitchen table and I thought, okay, if I could convince them that they really needed to learn, then I could probably teach them something. And out of that, created one of these games and went the next morning and said, okay, how many of you guys think you're great planners? And they all put their hands up. I said, okay, and how many of you think that it's a complete waste of time listening to me? And they all put their hands up. I said, okay, I get it. So give me 2 hours. And if at the end of 2 hours you don't think it's worth anything, I'll leave. And in the 2 hours, I want you just to play a game with me. But the deal is you have to answer a question if you accept this. They said, yep, that's great, 2 hours. That's better than a whole day. And what's your question? I said, how many of you think that you can optimize your performance every time? And, of course, every hand goes up. So I'm looking at all these senior guys. I said, okay, well, we'll play this game. And we did something called Gold of the Desert Kings. And it's a race across the desert. And to be successful, you have to plan and manage your time. And about 40% of the teams actually died in the desert. They just ran out of food and water because they didn't plan properly. And the remainder just brought back a small portion of the treasure that was possible in the game. So at the end, I said, so how many of you think you optimize every opportunity? And like, no hands. And I said, okay, well, you understand, this game that you just played is a metaphor for how you run your business. So if I could show you how to optimize in your business, would that be worthwhile? And they said, yeah, actually, it would, to their credit. So I got to stay for the day, and the career went from there, and that was it. So the creation of the games was really a matter of, okay, I got to come up with some way to teach differently than all the other ways if I want to keep my job. So it worked, and the rest was just...
Now I'm picturing this in my mind, and the question came up. So is it mostly companies, like a whole company in a workshop, mostly of what you do, or is it often people from various companies? Because there might be different experience doing a game like that with coworkers versus maybe doing a game with people from various companies? Is it different? What are your workshops consist of mostly?
Yeah, we only sell into corporations. So
okay.
We go in and we do what we call a discovery. We kind of understand their needs.
Mm-hmm.
And then we tailor the debrief of the experience to that particular organization. And sometimes if you think of a leadership day, the experience and the debrief may only be 2 to 3 hours, and the rest we're teaching the models. And
right.
Sometimes we will run these programs in large conferences, like 3,000 people in one big room. And we
wow.
run through one of the – yeah, it's very cool. It's kind of like Hollywood. There's sound, like music, smoke. It's great.
Nice.
And because the people want learning and they want a high-energy environment. So we theme the games up, come in costume, we have lots of music, and they think they're having like this great time. And then at the end, the facilitator will stand up and debrief for usually about 45 minutes. And the debrief is all tailored to the specific thing that the client wants out of that conference. So because
3,000 people, that's a lot of people. That's amazing.
Yeah, we've done them on the Great Wall of China. We've done them in the desert. But just a couple of weeks ago, we did two back-to-back sessions of 700 people each, two different cities. So in any given month, there's hundreds of people going through these programs.
Wow. And do you do like any follow-up or
yep.
you keep in touch with those people? Because those people will go on to do some amazing things.
Yes. I think as a company, we need to be better at our follow-up. We've always tried to do it, but I don't think we're doing a good enough job, so we're actually working on that right now. But in terms of the learning component, one of the offerings that we give to the client is they go through this event with us, and the learnings
mm-hmm.
are top of mind. We have a series of things we can do for the following 4 months to make sure that it stays top of mind. So that's what we call learning retention that we can give them.
Okay. And implementation retention, because you're not just wanting
yeah.
them to you don't want to follow up for 4 months to know they learned it. You want to know follow up for 4 months to make sure they did it.
They practice it, yeah. And I think the big difference here is we have something we call outcome-based leadership. So a
okay.
leader is really charged with producing an outcome, not just to, you know, just lead. You got to lead for a certain purpose. So in outcome-based leadership, we train the leaders how to make sure the leadership training we taught in the class is actually applied on the job. So you might take a program like Leading Through Times of Change with us, but you
mm-hmm.
would also take outcome-based leadership. So when you go back on the job, your boss is equipped to help you implement what you learned in the class. So
wow.
it's very pragmatic, yeah. It's if you
now,
take the whole process, you get that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, you 1.5 million people, there must be like many, many countries represented in that many people. How did you, obviously, it must be great training. I was going to say, how do you get it from Canada, where you're starting
yep.
to introduce it? You start in your basement. A lot of great companies start in their basement.
yep.
And then how did it happen that, oh, now I'm doing a bunch of people from this country, this country, this country? How did that happen? Because that's amazing. With 1.5 million, you must have people from around the world involved in the course or graduates.
We have a large volume in North America that we sell ourselves. So we sell and market into all of North America, which is a
right.
huge population for us.
Mm.
After 25 years, of course, it cumes up. But almost right from the beginning, we looked for what we call licensees. So these are companies that are standalone organizations in their own country, Romania or Russia or somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And they are usually running their own programs, their own material. And they come to us and we interview them and they interview us. And if the marriage works, then
mm-hmm.
they are licensed to represent us. So they will then take our programs and they will incorporate them into their content. So if you're in Russia taking a sales training course, for example, put on by one of our licensees in Russia, you
mm-hmm.
may actually, as part of your sales training course, have one of our experiences. So they actually they're like agents or like a franchisee
mm-hmm.
operation.
Well,
so
I worked at one time for Brian Tracy,
yeah.
Licensee here in Mississauga, And that's exactly what he does, and it's around the world, and it allows you to deliver the same training around the world, but customized because it's in each different territory. So language can be customized, different cultures can customize to their culture, and it makes a great, great model, and it allows some great entrepreneurs and leaders in other countries to have something a model that they can sell to businesses. So what a great idea. What was the first country outside of North America?
England. It was
England.
Easy for us because of the language. Yeah.
And oh, the language.
Yeah. And then Brazil became a huge, huge business for us. And we just kind of spread out from there.
Does it? Is it like around the world, is the training delivered about 95% the same with
yep.
some cultural variation?
Yep. Exactly. Exactly. Well, the cultural variations, surprisingly, are not as much as you would think. We did it this way in order to do the cultural adaption, but because they're principle-based, the culture isn't that critical. I think if you go into the actual game design itself, so for example, if one of the games is a competitive design, in some of the Asian cultures, you have to modify it to make it a little more collaborative. But that's more in the game design for the culture. But the learnings are pretty universal. They don't change much.
I love that. I love that because, again, I'm thinking Napoleon Hill's success principles. They're principles. They're not strategies. They're not something new. They're principles, and a principle is the same in every country, you know, if you serve others, you'll benefit. Same in every country. If you go the extra mile, you'll benefit. Same in every country. So, yeah, as you said, if it's principle-based training, the differences can really be pretty marginal, except for just maybe language.
Exactly. And I think, Tom, the other thing is it doesn't stop in the building. So when they go out, they go back home, you know, you're a better mother, you're a better father, you're a better husband, you're better with your church group, scout group, whatever you're with, you can bring those principles into bear. So they have an application that goes beyond just in the corporate setting. So we
and
really
that
try
must
to...
be that must be something when you have your feet up maybe at the end of a year or when you're thinking back on 25 years that the impact you had on people is not just on their job. You could have impacted way more than 1.5 million graduates for that same reason. They could be Boy Scout leaders, hockey coaches, volunteers in their church. They can be influential people in Rotary, Chamber of Commerce. And so what you teach them that they can learn on their job, now they're a better leader with everything. So you could impact their kids, their wives, their families, their group organizations. And so really the mushroom effect of 1.5 million graduates is probably like over 10 million people that are impacted by the learning that you've taught these people. And that must be worth almost as much as a lot of money.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, we talk within the company here about making a difference in the lives of people. So if you were kind of to pull together the whole organization and talk about our values, a lot of what people are here for is to make a difference in the lives of people, which gets back to behavior training. We're not really doing training. We're trying to do the results of training. And that's a big difference.
Mm-hmm. Now, in your new book, Lead Yourself, Lead Others, we can't through the whole book. So is there one or two concepts that are really, really the most important for readers to take away out of that book?
It's an interesting question here, I think, Tom. There are two things, one sort of implicit and one explicit. If I do the explicit one first, I think the section on balance is really important. I know we talk a lot about family-wife balance, but...
Mm-hmm.
In this book, you know, I talk about half a dozen different ways to get balance. And so often a leader has a difficult task because they are faced with the issue of the moment, the challenge of the moment, the crisis of the moment, either the employee is not doing the job that they should, or there's more volume coming in or something. And it's very tough to maintain personal balance, I think. And I think people tend to feel that balance is something that you have to sort of settle the books at the end of every day or week, and I don't think that's practical. I think you need over a period of time, some cycle of your business life, maybe a couple months or something, you may have to push in one area, but then you need to come back and make sure that that doesn't become the norm, that you get out of balance because you're always adopting one approach. And there's so many things where I believe a leader is really got a tough job. I mean, there's the very definition of leadership is people follow you because you're at the front. You know, when you're at the front, the path isn't always that clear. It's okay when you're at the back of the line because there's a beaten path. But when you're at the front, the path isn't clear often. So the leader has got to make choices, and they're trying to choose, is it, do I do this, do I do that, short-term, long-term? Do I, you know, exercise my authority, or do I get involvement from others? And that's, this particular chapter talks a lot about that. So I think that's very helpful, and something I've kind of learned over the years. The other thing is more implicit. And when people come and say, okay, Phil, what are the two qualities you look for when you hire? The two are integrity and teachability. And integrity has a section in here, but teachability, I think, is so important, Tom. Most people will say they are teachable, but what they mean is they listen really well. They have hearability, but not teachability. It means they heard you, they understood you, they made notes, they decided that they wanted to do something about it, but they didn't actually do anything with what they heard. Because teachability means, okay, I heard it, I assessed it, it makes sense to me, and therefore I will do something with it. I will be taught. I will be different. I will behave differently. And it's so hard for someone to distinguish between teachability and hearability because they think, well, I'm really good. Yeah, listen, I heard everything you said. I go, well, frankly, I really don't care. What I care about is, are you going to do something with what I said? And I think the other thing that's implicit through this book is the opportunity to learn and to be taught and to sort of gain value. You don't have to agree. If you don't agree, then pitch it. But if you do agree, then what are you going to do with it? And I tried to write it in a way that it was easy for people to say, okay, you know, I can do something with this. I don't have to wade through. It's pretty clear. This is the outcome I'd like, and this is what I do. So those are sort of the two key tenets I would think of that when you ask me
about, yeah, I love it.
Share with it. Yeah.
And the balance one is so important. I read a book last year, a year before, called Full Engagement, and it talks exactly what you just said about, yeah, that life is not linear. Maybe you're on a business project that just takes a lot of your time for 3 months, but then it would say, then you need to get back into balance for, like, you know, a period of time,
exactly. Yep.
Reconnect. So it talked more about going full speed at some things for a short period of time, and then reconnecting, go full speed at something, you know, and then reconnect. Even during a working day, focus 100% full speed, but every 3-4 hours, get out, walk around, talk to somebody, redirect your thinking. And it's so important, but so many people, as you say, they think it's a linear thing. Okay, out of the 7 days, I did this 2.5 times, I did this once. Your life doesn't go linear. And so if you just keep it in mind and practice, but don't feel guilty if you're on a 2-month trip of extreme focus in one area. It, you know, it's not going to set you off for life unless you never redirect back to the other areas.
Exactly. Yep. Perfect. Yep.
And then I've heard Jack Welch, I think, and a lot of people talk about hire the right person. And I think maybe that's a part of what you're talking about. If you hire the right person who has those principles and character traits, and hard work are going to show up early and stay late and be there every single day, you can teach them the type this and this fast a period, or put this or do that. You can teach them the processes involved in the job, but if you have the right person in that job, you may be better than saying someone who, for instance, typing. If someone may be the fastest typer, but they may not be the best person for the job. And so it sounds like you look at those areas more than simply, you know, can they do this task the fastest or the best?
Yep, absolutely. I mean, character is not something that we talk about a lot in business, but for me, character is everything. And, it, you know, at Eagle's Flight, we turn down people more because we don't think they're compatible with our values than we do because they don't have the skills. We can find the skills. But, you know, our values are very, very clear, you know, ethical profit and focus on customer service and leadership excellence. The values are pretty clear. So you need folks that are willing to live by those values, and then you can teach them what they don't need, what they don't have when they come in, rather. And I think there's a section here on character, and it's only because I think early in your career, people may be tempted to compromise on the character, and that, in fact, is what, at the senior level, you look for more than anything else.
Exactly, and I think of my dad, who's in the explosives industry his whole life, and some of the key people he worked with, and people that my dad worked with, that's what they would say, is character. You got your full money's worth value, and you knew that the integrity was there, and if you can be that kind of person, any organization will want you because they can teach you what you need to know to actually do the job. And so over a long period of time, if you want to be a success, you have to maintain that character integrity every day. And you're right, when you're young, you may chase money and let integrity slide a bit. That will pay off in negative ways for a long time. And so teaching young leaders about that and to think long term in their career and their reputation and their integrity, that can really prevent a lot of errors and help people focus on the right things. So now in today's workplaces, why do you think this book is particularly relevant? Because I'm 50, so when I spend time now, I'm thinking, oh, when I was young, workplaces were different, and we did this and that. And so why is the book really particularly relevant to workplaces today?
Let me answer that in a couple of ways. I think I heard a story of a friend of mine whose wife was working at a store, and the people working in the store were incredibly well-trained to do the work that needed to be done. But his wife actually left that particular organization. And when asked why, she said, well, I was incredibly well-trained, but my boss knew nothing about people. He didn't understand how to manage a team. He didn't understand, how to give good feedback. He didn't understand how to communicate. So he was technically very strong, but on the people side, he was very weak. And she went looking for some place where she could find a leader who had both. And I think in today's world, we have a workforce that's coming in that expects to be led in such a way that they can be fully utilized. They're happy to learn the technical skills of the job, but they also want to be harnessed. They want to be engaged. They want to be part of a team. They want to contribute. They want their voice to be heard. And the workforce today is smart. It's intelligent. It has access to an incredible amount of information. They're technologically very strong. So I think the demands of the leaders, especially at the sort of the early in the leadership career, are huge, because you have these young leaders who have to manage a very intelligent, highly motivated workforce, and they don't have a clue how to do it. So I felt that we needed something that would help with that. So that would be kind of my first thought. My second thought would be, which ties the two together, someone was once asked, Jay, you're a really good leader. How come you're such a great leader? The guy said, well, I have really good judgment. Well, how did you get such really good judgment? He said, oh, well, through my experiences. Well, then how did you get that experience? He said, bad judgment. And I think there's a bit of a paradox there, that most of the time we have to get our experience the hard way. So we make, early in our career, we make decisions that aren't the best, so that bad experiences help us to not make them again. And what I wanted to do is I thought, okay, here's this whole group of young leaders in the workforce who are managing these bright people who really want to contribute. And the only way they can learn, really, is by making a lot of mistakes and learning the hard way. So what would happen if I could capture some principles that essentially said, here is your experience in a book. It's 96 pages. They're the key areas that you need to think about. And if you can get your head wrapped around these, you don't need to make all these mistakes. Just go and practice what's in the book. It'll keep you from making the mistakes. It will let you be a better leader. You won't have nearly the high turnover that you're probably experiencing. Probably get better performance, and you'll kind of harness the energy of your workforce. So I think it was the congruence of that story about my friend's wife who left because she didn't have a good leader, and me being aware of the fact that it doesn't have to be that way. If you could just make it simple enough that these young leaders could say, okay, this is what I got to do, just do it, they're off and running. So that was sort of the genesis for the book.
Now, would you think that I'm thinking of leaders today versus, say, leaders 20, 25 years ago? It seems to me that leaders today, young leaders especially, need to manage the emotional intelligence of themselves and their followers more than, say, leaders of 25 years ago. I don't think they got so much into the emotional intelligence of themselves, managing that and managing their followers. It was, you do this, this is your task, go out and do it, get it done. But now a leader, I think, has to manage a lot more things than just the task. They have to manage people's emotions and feelings and day-to-day performance. Do you think that's a change from 20, 25 years ago?
Absolutely. Absolutely. There's no question in my mind. I think 20 to 25 years ago, an individual career was more linear. There was a clear path.
Mm-hmm.
There was a clear set of steps, and you kind of did what you needed to do, and you were managing folks along that path. Today, it's definitely not linear. People move jobs far more frequently. They are far more motivated to have their own life in balance. They're not necessarily willing to just do nothing but work. But when they're at work, they're willing to give much more. So you've got a nonlinear environment with people who are thinking way differently than they were doing 25 or 30 years ago. So it's a much more difficult. You've got emotional intelligence to worry about. You have the person's value system. Everybody's value system is very different now. It's not all about just about climbing the ladder. Money isn't the sole motivator for folks. People have different career aspirations, different retirement aspirations. The actual things which leaders have to manage now are far more complicated. The technical jobs, the information flow, the pace. So if you think you're a young leader, boy, it's a real challenge. You're managing a demanding workforce in a demanding environment that is highly competitive, and you need some skills because it's less about managing the things and much more about managing the people than it ever was before, I think.
Exactly, and part of that leadership involves being enough of a leader that people want to stay with you, I would think, because in this day and age, you could pour leadership training and skills and all kinds of amazing things into people, and people are mobile. They could leave after 2.5 years, whereas 25 years ago, if you poured your company training into someone, you knew that's okay, they're with us for 25 years. We're going to let them know everything, train them on everything, and they'll use that forever. Now you could give them your best stuff and create great leaders and great followers and great employees, and 2 years later they're just jumping because they now have all these new skills that they can use somewhere else for more money, more opportunity, whatever it may be. And so if you are a great leader, people may tend to work for you or work with that company longer than if you let it slide a little bit.
Yep, I agree. I think you're spot on, Tom. I think there's two significant benefits of being a great leader. I think the people working for you are significantly more productive and happy. So that's clearly a benefit to the shareholder. But the other thing is the one constant that has been with us, not just the last 25 years, but for a long, long time, for generations, and that is if you find a really great leader who practices what they preach or walks the talk or whatever, if you find a leader who is willing to care for you and who you really can trust, then you will harness yourself to that leader for as long as possible. I think the working for a great leader is a privilege, and when you find one, you tend to stick. So investing in making your leaders really great has the dual benefit. When you improve the corporate productivity, but you also minimize your retention, or maximize your retention, I guess, so that you get the double benefit there. Because I agree with you. I think if you find a great leader, that is really valuable. And so you tend to stay and want to be part of that team.
Exactly. And I think if, I don't have kids, but if I were a parent, I would insist that my kid maybe work for a great leader, if even if it paid less, than work for a poor leader that paid more, because of what it will make of yourself and the long-term benefits to your career to be working with a great leader who cares about you. And great leaders, one of the great signs of great leaders is they want to build you up so that you're better than they are.
Exactly.
And so, you know, if I had a choice to direct a kid, I would say go work for that great leader. It pays less. But in the end, what it'll make of you and your career will be way more than the money this year that you'll make.
Yep, I agree. And I think the current workforce would agree with you. They appreciate that. I mean, it's not like you're having to, you know, beg them kicking and screaming to stay working for a great leader. I think when they find one, they like them. So,
right, and there's enough bad ones out there that they know the difference. They could see, geez, I worked for three other companies, and they weren't like this at all.
That's true. Yeah. That's
and great. Then also, when you have an environment like that, I imagine employees start telling their friends, like, man, you got to come work here. This is a great spot. Like, you've worked at some crappy places, but this is amazing. And so it builds your culture because now people are dying to work for you. Their friends are telling friends that you got to come work with this guy. You're going to become a great person.
Absolutely. Yeah, I would absolutely agree.
And that makes it kind of a contagious culture where people are almost fighting to get their friends in there to help them and their careers and the company at the same time. So maybe the last one, I can see the words in the question. Why is it so important? Why do you think principled, consistent leadership is so important? And those two words just kind of tell you what the focus is and the importance. But principled and consistent, because really in this day and age you have one or two bad days where you blow off steam, do something nutty, your consistency of leadership now is questioned.
Absolutely. I think the best way to kind of clarify that is to think of the opposite of principle, which is practice. So if I know how to do something, that is practice. So I know how to change the toner in the photocopier. So as long as I have that toner and that photocopier, I can do it. So that practice is, I've got that down to a science. But a principle allows me to take some truth and apply it in many, many different situations. So it is something which will serve me instead across many circumstances rather than just one. So if you teach now we do teach practice, obviously. You got to teach practice in leadership. There's some specific things you got to do. But if you think about principles such as have a learning mindset or, you know, demonstrate integrity or be open-minded, that principle you can apply when you're in a meeting with your boss, with a subordinate, with a colleague, with a supplier, with a customer. You can take that principle and it has a universal application. So that's why I thought it was more important to teach principle than in practice in this book. In the bigger, thicker one that I wrote before is much more about practice, but this was more principle. And I think, so that's why, because I think it helps them more. They can apply it more frequently. And I think consistency ties to that, because one of the things that leaders have is the challenge of managing many different people, and every person is different. So how do I manage four different personality types if all I'm thinking about is practice, the right way to manage? If I think about a principle, then I can be more consistent because I can manage everybody with the same degree of tolerance or patience or integrity. So it allows me to be a much more effective leader when I'm managing a wide array of folks.
Wow, and you have me smiling till my edge of my mouth touches my ears, because when I managed people, I really did find out that there are many kinds of personalities, and not everybody is like me, and some of the people I managed got the best results of the whole group, but were the most, let's say, unlike me.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you have to learn to be a leader that can motivate and lead all kinds of people, not just people like yourself. And so that is a great point, because you're not always going to recruit people that are just like you. You may have some of your best performers who are really unlike you. And so to be a proper leader, you've got to be able to lead them as well as the ones who are more in tune with who you are as a person.
Yep, it's very true. And I think part of the challenge with teaching principle is how do I put the principle into practice? And I think one of the ways we set the book up, I was trying to do it in a way that's, okay, if I get the principle, how do I apply it in practice? Because you still need the detailed steps. So It's finding the balance here between those two, Tom, which I think is why the book is set up the way it is.
Important balance, for sure. And so now, the best way to find you, I guess, is eaglesflight.com. Is that right?
Yep.
E-A-G-L-E-S, flight.com. And that is an amazing website. You've got some really great stuff on there. I've been on it numerous times, and I love that website. It's really well put together. And so eaglesflight.com, and we'll have this blog page up soon. And people go buy that book. You'll find it on eaglesflight.com. And if you're a young leader especially, and so many people aspire to be leaders, and a lot of younger ones now, you don't have to have 25 years experience anymore to become a leader. You can become a leader from your character. And so get this book, because you'll learn principles of leadership, and principles, as Phil said, they're timeless. They're not just for today, and they'll take you a lot further than if you don't know them. So thanks so much for your time today, Phil. I really appreciate it, and you got some really, really great ideas there for young leaders. They need to be reading that book and finding out more about Eagle's Flight.
Thanks, Tom. It was a pleasure to chat.
Have an amazing day.
Okay. Thanks a lot. Bye now.